If you are the child of a very successful business, or your parents have a name, a surname, which sometimes is the case, your identity precedes you. Everyone thinks of the anxious generation as being, you know, current teenagers. We're the anxious generation.
My two-year-old is at nursery and I get updates 6 times a day with, this is a picture of them doing this, and this is their lunch, and this is how long they slept, and this is when they did a pee and their nappy.
Parents are typically very, very good at preparing the money for the child. They're not so good at preparing the child for the money. I think what's really important for parents to understand, however, is what is a normal adolescent growing pain and what is a problem?
Probably it'd be quite useful to understand from your perspective what you do. It's not something that I've ever heard of before.
I'm a psychological consultant, a mediator, and the founder of Dallington. Now, Dallington is a mentoring practice for teens and 20-somethings. Yeah. And their parents from successful and affluent families. Now, why this needs to exist, you might say, I think we all remember, and anybody who's listening to this podcast will remember, is that the journey from adolescence to adulthood, for most of us, is pretty rocky. Yes. But there is this misconception that if you come from money, if you come from a successful family or a multi-generational family business, that that journey should be easy. And of course, in some cases, that's absolutely the case. And I'm always really conscious to note that, like, privilege, we don't ignore the benefits of privilege. And it does make things easier to have those resources. But there are also unseen challenges that come with that, that frankly, there's very little empathy for, there's very little understanding about. And therefore, when you don't have those things, there's very, very little support for. So I created Dallington off the back of working in a family office advisory for about 8 years and seeing all those challenges and wanting to provide something for it.
How do they find you? I mean, I suppose from a, if they're speaking to their lawyer and accountant from a family office perspective, then it makes sense for them, you should be integrated with that.
So how people find me is, their family office advisor, their lawyer, their banker, their psychiatrist, their GP. If they know about me, then they're likely to recommend me. But what you're really talking about, which is really interesting and a point that I would love more people to understand, is what is a cultural difference. So first generation wealth creators who have children who, and you're second gen, aren't you?
Second gen family business.
Family business, which does change things because there's a difference between coming from a family business or just inherited wealth, and we can get into that. But what we're really talking about is a cultural change. So first generation, the average, not all, but the average first generation wealth creator of a, you know, significant success will have typically come from quite a low income background. They most likely didn't go to private school. If they did, it would have been everything their parents could have saved and put together to put them through that, and they knew it. They most likely didn't go to tertiary education, to university. They won't have lived in big houses and gone on big, nice holidays or sat in, you know, business or first class seats. They wouldn't have tutors or family advisors around them. But they get to a certain level of success, and understandably, and it always comes from a place of love, so we never knock it, but they want to provide all these wonderful things for their children because they work really hard and they want to show them the world and send them to the best schools. Of course they do. The problem with that is, as the first generation wealth creator will tell you, and I'm sure lots of your clients who have, are self-made, is that all of those, what may have seemed like challenges, were what built them. They are what gave them their resilience. They have a great relationship with failure. You know, all of their sort of big successes will have come off the back of learning from a failure, from a mistake. Then what I see is, in my practice, parents saying, I have an 18-year-old who's failed one of their A-levels and has totally fallen apart. How can this be possible? I was, you know, working on a shop floor from the age of 15, you know. So
they're two completely different lives.
Yeah.
That the first generation wealth creator almost can't understand.
Mm. And it's really tricky for them because, again, it comes from a place of love. It's best intention. They want to make this lovely life for their child, and then some of the results of that aren't what they want. So typically it's issues with resilience, grit. These are the parents' words, I should add. Yeah. Sometimes entitlement, that's a tough one as well. Yeah. How do you avoid entitlement? You know, when parents say, oh, I want my child just to be grateful because I've worked so hard for them and I've provided this life for them, The problem is your child doesn't know that this is special because this is their reality. Yeah. They go to, especially if they're at school, in private school, a lot of the people around them look the same, go on the same holidays.
Yeah, they're surrounded by, it's all normal.
Exactly, it's all normal. So they don't know this is, you know, an amazing gift that their parents have really worked hard for. And there are lots of tools, you know, and we can talk about that as to how you bridge that gap, but we just have to acknowledge the cultural difference between that first and second generation wealth. Yeah.
What emotions do the parents have to force them to come to you?
That's a really good question. I've never been asked it, so thank you. I think it's a mixture, and it actually depends on the birth order. When I've got the, if I'm working
birth
with
order of the parents
of the child, if it child, yes, if I'm working with the third or fourth child, by that point it might be it's a frustration or an exhaustion, which is, you know, I've been really trying this a long time now, and you know, I've got lots going on. I've got a full house to run, maybe a business and the children, and I need help. Yeah, I need somebody to help me out here. So there's that. With the first child, it might just be, we have thought about this a lot. We've talked about this. We want to get it right. And they're the ones who are already having those really thoughtful conversations with their wealth managers and their bankers, who are saying, you know, if you're a first-gen wealth creator, things are going to change. Have you thought about how this might impact your family? And they're the ones going, okay, let's talk about this in advance.
We deal with a lot of wealthy people that have been very successful, either multi-generational or founders of businesses in their lifetime. And I'm also a parent, and I'm obviously a son. And we interact with a lot of family offices that help people financially. Mm-hmm. And you were explaining that there's a lot of help for people with money, with the money side of things. Mm-hmm. But explain what you saw at the family office. That
so my sort of phrase is that parents are typically very, very good at preparing the money for the child. They're not so good at preparing the child for the money. Okay. And when I say money, I don't just mean money. I mean the business, estates, everything that goes with that. And when I say child, that can be any age. But most people are preparing all of those aspects, and they're not sitting down with their child and thinking, how can we make you resilient in if something were to go wrong? How can we educate you on the things that the average young person isn't going to learn? So the average young person isn't going to be a beneficiary of a trust. But in my world, every single young person I work with is a beneficiary of a trust. And most of them don't even know what a beneficiary is, who their trustee is, how that setup works, or what to do in a worst case scenario. And they should know.
I've been seeing a therapist for about 4.5 years. For me, the topic of parenting is, I'm so keen to get it right. Mm. And as you said, like, every parent comes from a good place. Yeah. When someone comes to you, you've got those two examples there. You've got one who's trying to predict it, and you've got someone that's
trying to fix
kind of
it.
Exhausted and trying to fix
it. Yeah.
What sort of examples will people come to you with? Let's start maybe the first one. You know, if someone's exhausted and it's the third or fourth child, what are the sort of steps you can take at that point?
Yeah, so it's a range, and I don't want anybody listening to this to think we're talking about your, you know, rich kid of Instagram on the Daily Mail front line. That's not what we're talking about, actually. That's quite rare. We're talking about most of your clients, I imagine, which are, you know, very hardworking, millennial or ex-gen, you know, first generation wealth creators who have worked the socks off. But as a result of that, understandably, not taking their eye off the ball with parenting, because that's really unfair, but they've just been investing a lot of that time into that with best intention to create a better life for their children. The problem with that is that obviously some things do fall through the cracks. Millennial parents are sort of the first generation to be beat up from both sides, is the phrase, which is, we had much stricter parents, you know, you generally speaking, and then we have in turn done the full soft, gentle parenting, right?
Yeah,
tell me your emotions, I'm on the floor with you, look at me, you know, like, I'm here with you. Did your parents ever do that with you?
No, that wasn't the vibe.
No, it wasn't mine either.
I'm not saying this for you, but for me, I think a lot about, you know, I've got this influence from my parents that I'm thinking maybe I want it to be a bit gentler.
Yeah.
But then I'm thinking, well, I really want them to find the resilience. That, you know, yeah. I'm really pleased how me and my siblings have come out yeah. from the environment that my parents created. So it's like, well, how do you create that resilience and that sort of hardworking attitude yeah. and the, you know, all of those things that I'm really proud of. Mm. But I'm parenting in a completely different way that created me. So.
I know, it's really hard to find the balance. And by the way, you're just one of like, we're all doing the same.
Yeah.
Okay. But I think the number one thing is, and it's really, really tough, and I say this knowing how tough it is because I practice what I preach, we have to let them suffer a little bit. We really do. And all the things that you will count your resilience for is because your parents did let you, partly because they might not have even known, you know, you were off. Or maybe, I don't know if it's, I was away at school. I don't know if you were.
I was away at school.
Yeah, so they didn't necessarily see what you had to get on with. And there wasn't a phone to call home and get upset about it. And yeah. you know who was in charge? The teachers, not the students. All of those aspects really helped you to get resilient. Whereas, you know, we know everything that goes on in our children's day to day. I mean, I get, you know, I understand what my child is eating for every meal on the weekly bulletin.
Yeah, I mean, my nursery, my two-year-old is at nursery and I get updates 6 times a day with this is a picture of them doing this and this is their lunch and this is how long they slept and this is when they did a pee and their nappy.
Exactly. And you know who are running those nurseries?
Yeah.
Millennials. It's cultural again. It's just how do you bridge these gaps? You know, be gentle whilst letting a little bit of suffering. Let them fail. Failure, super, super important. My goodness. I always say parents need to talk about failure around the table. So, you know, the old-fashioned... Everyone, you have a family meal and everyone says, what did you do today? And how well did everyone do? Do the opposite. You know, everybody from the youngest to the eldest should say, this is what I failed at. Be that I cheated on a test. I said something cruel to somebody. I was late for this because it humanizes it. And it also shows you that your parents also make mistakes, but they crack on and you're going to change it and do something better next time. I'm keen to come on to though you and your being part of a family business.
Yeah.
Which is, did you grow up knowing that was the path or was it something that you chose?
There was never any pressure for us to do it.
Yeah.
But it was a huge part of our life. Mm-hmm. My mum and dad both worked there. We lived in London until I was 10. And from my earliest memories, my parents worked so hard. Mm-hmm. And they worked so many hours. So they'd always come back for bath time, but then they'd go back to the office. And I remember with me and my siblings, we'd be sitting at the top of the stairs at sort of 9, 10, 11 o'clock, sort of waiting for them to come back and sending them little notes. And so there was never any pressure to join, but there was a huge sense of that was life.
Yeah.
And I think there was sort of pride and interest in it because, I mean, there's also a lot of this stuff around that people say, if you want your kids to be interested in something, don't ask them to be interested in it, mm-hmm. but do the thing
yeah.
and they copy you.
Absolutely.
And I think that because my parents didn't put any pressure on us, but they showed such a sense of pride in what they did. And I think we all were quite interested in it and we were quite intrigued to get that same feeling. Yeah, I mean, I felt incredibly lucky when half of my peers were struggling to get jobs and I was looking around amazing houses. Mm. So I felt really fortunate to do that.
Well, I think, no, that is. And I think it's lovely because what your parents did was they modelled. They didn't tell you. They modelled what they wanted you to see, which is really important. It's all very, you can't, as we know with our own children, you can sit there till cows come home telling them a way to be, but if you show them, that's what they'll model.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in the difference of growing up with a family business and growing up with wealth, because they are different. And I've worked with both, which is if you're growing up in a very wealthy context where parents maybe are investors, there's been a financial business, but there's no, you know, family trading. Business, yeah. Exactly. That absolutely has its benefits, but it's also got sort of no vessel to contain, some of the energy and also some of the challenges. Mm. You know, it's actually really helpful being a teenager and having something to kick against and say, yeah. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to choose my own path and then come back to it later if
That's
they
interesting.
Want. Whereas a family business, If you are given the choice, which is very important because not everybody is, but if you are given the choice, it can really be a, you know, I think the phrase is a runway, not a tunnel. You know, you're given this option and you've already got the runway. It's not sort of a, you have to do it. So having the choice. But I would always say to parents who, when there is a family business, do exactly what yours did, which is it's a choice. But if you can, I would take it a step further and say, you cannot join until you've gone off and done a couple of other things first, because then they'll really value it.
Yeah. I completely agree with you. I think the idea of going off and doing something else first is really important. And I actually went traveling for a year after about 10 years of being at the business. Mm-hmm. And that was my kind of, what else is out there? Who am I? And I think the interesting thing with the family business, it's really interesting that it's a thing to kick against. I like that idea. And but it also creates an incredible amount of identity. Mm-hmm. And what I've realized is that being one of six, going to school together, and then immediately going into business together, I never really had an opportunity to. I think if you go to university on your own and you're away from your parents, you're away from your siblings, you have this chance to sort of reinvent yourself, mm-hmm. or sort of just tweak yourself slightly. And I probably didn't feel I had the opportunity to do that. And I think going traveling was this opportunity to see what else was out there, review my identity as not part of the business. Yeah. And actually coming back, I came back with the idea of starting a new business. Mm. But over 3 to 6 months, I realized that how lucky I was and how much knowledge I'd gathered and how extraordinary it was working with family. Yeah. And without that, I don't think I would have been as grateful and as excited about what we're doing now. So I think that's completely...
That's a really good point. It doesn't... So I've always said it should be before you join the family business, but actually it doesn't matter. Maybe it's 5 or 10 years down the line, but taking a step away to, like you say, have real gratitude for what's there, and feel like you have made a very conscious choice and this is part of your identity that you've chosen. The identity piece is huge, and it is really a big one. I mean, our adolescent years are all about identity. I don't know about you. I was a different person every week when I was 17. And I went from being a goth 1 week to being, you know, all preppy and Ralph Lauren the next week. You're figuring out. You have to try all these different hats on. But if you are the child of a very successful business, or your parents have a name, a surname, which sometimes is the case, your identity precedes you. And imagine starting your career and walking into a room and everyone goes, "This is Bertie. This is Alan's son."
Yeah, I know how that feels.
Yeah, I bet you do.
And it's, to be honest, it was because my mum and dad didn't speak about it that much. It was extraordinary, mm-hmm. because the words that people said about my dad were just completely blew me away.
Oh.
And that was that's one of the amazing things about it. Mm-hmm. Sort of continuing to develop relationships with your family beyond childhood, mm-hmm. is such a huge benefit of the family business side of things. But it does come with, and there were benefits to it. People, you know, as an estate agent, no one trusts you. That's your biggest weakness. So I got this like automatic trust from a lot of the community, so because true. Of my lineage, mm-hmm. my surname.
Yeah.
Which
that's your privilege.
That's my privilege. And that was a benefit, but also internally that created a lot of, you know, 2 years ago we rebranded, and it was a big moment to look at our identity and what people think of us as a business, and something that we'd never spoken about, but all of us kids felt guilty. Mm-hmm. We felt really privileged and lucky, and it wasn't anything to do with us. It was, mm-hmm. you know, we just got given this thing that, and it was a good moment for us all to sit around the table and think, actually people do like us and respect us for what we've done, and the family thing is a good thing.
That's a rite of passage. I've seen it so often with my mentees that it's not something you can actually force. It has to come naturally, which at some point they go, I have to just let go of this. I didn't choose this. I know I'm so lucky, but I can't carry around this guilt forever. You know, I do something positive with it, but I can't carry it around, because I've had, you know, as you can imagine, lots of young people come through my doors because they've actually refused a lot of help in the past, because God forbid they look like they're ungrateful. And they will get told things like, you know, you have all of this, you have this wealth or this business or whatnot. And what have you got to be sad about? What have you got to be anxious about? Yeah. And that's really, you know, unfair and quite cruel.
What is it, the feeling that kids have at that age they want to kick back from? Was it just a natural, regardless of wealth?
Child or teenage?
Teenager.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these are boundary testing years. So I always say to parents, and I will say this to myself when my children are, yeah, I have to remind myself this when they're teenage years, which is detachment of any kind is painful. I don't care if it's your molar or leaving the family home. Detachment is painful, really necessary. When I see a, you know, 17, 18 year old suddenly overnight, seemingly rejecting their parents, saying, I'm not going home, I'm not eating your food, I'm not going to temple or whatever, I'm not doing the family business. Congratulations, you've got a great normal adolescent right there. That's so important, because in order to become your whole own whole self, you have to detach from the family unit. And there's not really a clean way of doing that. If they're hiding things from you, of course, there's a line of what's, you know, healthy and not. But if they're trying to become their own person, that's sometimes what's got to happen. And they need to know where their boundaries are. So I always say boundaries are really important because they allow you to have fun. If you can go, which to a teenager sounds awful because they're like, no, boundaries are not fun in any way, shape or form. But if you went to a theme park and you sat on one of the big roller coasters and they didn't put the thing over your chest to keep you in it, that'd be the worst 3 minutes of your life. Okay. The boundary they put in, the physical one, allows you to put your hands up and let go and have fun. Right. The same concept should be applied for adolescents, which is know where the line is, because trust me, they'll push it. And they should. So if you say your curfew is this, they'll push it here. If they say your budget is this, they push it here. But if there's no curfew and there's no budget, what happens? So I love Jo Frost. Do you remember Jo Frost, Super Nanny?
No.
It was a show back when we were younger. Okay. Anyway, she has a wonderful saying, which I really like, which is, say what you mean what you say, don't be mean. So say what you mean. This is where the boundary is, Bertie, and if you cross it, this will be the consequence. I love you. I like you. It doesn't change any of that, but this is where it is. And when they do, if you do hit that boundary, you follow through, but you aren't mean about it. And that's sort of the perfect millennial parenting tip I can give you. That's the balance that we can find. Yeah.
I mean, ours is, at the moment, our biggest one is our kids will eat two mouthfuls of their lunch and then they'll want pudding. And so there's just, at the moment, for the last month, there's been a boundary of, I love you.
Yeah.
Got to finish your meal and then you can have pudding.
Exactly.
Otherwise, there's no pudding.
And you see it through and you do not break and give them the pudding. Cannot break. And this is where, I mean, I feel like this is prison talk, but you know, you and your partner have to be completely aligned.
So how do you, actually with partners, so how, is it often the, can you stereotype, is it the mum or the dad that comes to you most often? And if it's one, then how do you get both aligned? Because I presume that's quite an important part.
I hate for it to sound stereotypical, but it is often the mother that comes to me. And that's probably just because they are having more visibility of what's going on in the child's life. It's no bad thing. What's really important is, okay, during those sort of adolescent, early 20s years, you're unlikely to go to your parent with some of the more private matters that you're dealing with or thinking about. And that's okay. That's really normal. But there should be somebody that you can go to. And in some cases, a therapist is appropriate. But for the average teenager and early 20-something, actually a therapist isn't necessary. It's somebody who is responsible, who is accountable, who can assess risk and say, well, yeah, this is going over what's reasonable. But let's be honest, if you ask your 17-year-old friend what you should do, most likely they're just going to say, do it.
Go for it.
It's about having that person in the middle that you can have the uncomfortable conversation, who will ask the question about consent, sex, boundaries, drugs, all of those things, because they do need to be talked about. But the chances are they're not going to speak to their teacher. They're not going to speak to their parent. They're not going to speak to anybody of, you know, significant authority. And that's why having that medium, and that can be, you know, that's what we do, but that could be an aunt you trust, family friend, but your, it's about, yes, exactly. Having somebody is important.
And I presume that's, there needs to be a lot of respect for that person, whoever it is. And I presume I suppose, you know, a godparent or a, and I presume that's what a godparent really is there for. You know, that's one of their purposes. Mm. If you're in that religion, but yeah. and uncle and aunt, and you've built that up over years. This is the role that you play as well. Do you find the respect element of it is, if a parent's sending them to you, does that, how do you build that? Is it important that you build it?
Yeah, it's a question we always get asked, which is who's the client? You know, ultimately the parent is the customer because, you know, to talk about the practicalities, it is a service that they pay for, but the client is the young person, because if the parent's the client, then how do we form any trust? If you're worried that everything I say is going to go back to your parent, then we've got nothing. Yeah. And I always make that really clear to the parent. So we always have family sessions where parents are involved, because that avoids there being sort of, you know, behind the scenes conversations and reports and whatnot. That's a chance for everybody to get around a table together and talk about what might be tricky. It's also a chance for me to really encourage the young person to start to advocate for themselves and help with conflict, which, you know, is a very normal part of late adolescence and early adulthood is having conflict.
Managing conflict is good for all ages, isn't it?
Oh, gosh, yes. I mean, so we do a lot of non-violent communication conflict practice, which is a very strong title. I don't know why they've done it, but I'll give you a really good example, which we'll be doing with our children in years to come, which is you state the problem. Okay, so for example, one I've helped parents with a lot is their children on their devices, okay, because they're not used to this.
Oh, that's a big topic.
It's a big topic, yeah. They come home, all they see is this, and they get really frustrated with it.
The parent gets really frustrated.
And their reaction might be to remove it, or to shout at them, or just to get really upset. And it's not getting them anywhere. So I say use this technique, which is you state what the problem is. You're on your phone too much. It makes me feel disconnected to you. I'd really appreciate it if you put it down and you can have it straight back after. This would make me feel closer to you. That sort of
sounds
model.
Easy.
It sounds really easy, doesn't it? But it can be applied to lots of things. And it's one of those things that actually gets much easier the more you practice it. But it's a good way of, because if you come in with emotion, because a young person is full of emotion. Yeah. So as a parent, you've got to show some, but you really have to sort of temper it out.
And so feels like you've got two roles. You've got, one is helping the parents, and one is helping the children.
Yeah.
So you're saying that the parent often is the customer because they're paying you. The child is often the client. Mm-hmm. But can you have both as clients?
Oh, absolutely. In an ideal world, they might not even need a me. Or a guide or a godparent of sorts. I think they'll always be beneficial. But a lot of these conversations should happen at home. And ideally, young people can go to their parents, but it isn't always the case. That doesn't mean that there are problems at home necessarily. I think people assume that if you have to have these conversations, that there's an issue with communication at home. Yeah. It's not the case. It's just a normal growing pain. I think what's really important for parents to understand, however, is what is a normal adolescent growing pain and what is a problem. When a parent comes to me and they're really concerned because their child is seemingly overnight distant with them, not talking to them, spending a lot more time in their room, on their phone more, their first fear is risk. Who are they speaking to? They're depressed, they're anxious. What if they're self-harming up there? I've got no idea what's going on. Vast majority of the time, everything is absolutely fine. So it's really just about establishing that, because as a parent, if you put that fear and anxiety into your child, that's really not helping. So it's about assessing what's normal and what's not.
I think understanding what is normal is really, I hadn't really thought about that, but that's really key.
Well, there's a wonderful book, if you haven't read it, The Anxious Generation.
It's on my bed table. I haven't started it yet.
It's a wonderful book. But everyone thinks of the anxious generation as being, you know, current teenagers. We're the anxious generation.
Okay.
We're the ones going, oh my gosh, because...
That's why I've got you on here asking you this question.
we put that anxiety into them by constantly being worried.
So we need to be more relaxed.
We need to be way more relaxed. Okay. We need to be way more reflective and not reactive. We're way too reactive because we can be. And this is where, again, wealth is a problem, which is, if you are a millennial and you have resources, God, you're reactive, because you can find a tutor and a psychiatrist. Getting a next day psychiatrist appointment isn't a problem because you have the money to do it. Yeah. There is something about the distance of waiting and just sitting with something. In the same way where, and this is the worst case scenario, when I've seen parents who have wanted to send their children to rehab because they've been acting up for, you know, a couple of months. And that acting up will come from something, but the reaction shouldn't be, I'm scared. I think I'm doing the best thing by putting them in a residential facility that will keep them safe. The problem is the trauma that comes from being sent to a residential facility. And I'm not knocking them, because some of them are necessarily and will save lives, but not all, you know. And a lot of this time, it's just what is a normal adolescent behavior. You've got to just sit with it. But it is really tough. And just be less reactive and be able to tolerate frustrations. I find a lot of parents, you know, including myself, I am not, you know, innocent in all of this. I have to learn it all the time as well and practice it. But tolerating your own fears and frustrations at the end of the day and seeing a problem and just wanting to fix it, it's really tough to just sit on your hands and see what happens and let them sort it out. There is one piece of advice which I want all parents to take on, of our, certainly of our generation, or ex-gen, which is money. Our children are unlikely to grow up with physical coins and cash the way that we did. And, you know, God knows where that's going to go. However, it doesn't mean they shouldn't learn how to use it. I say this because if you have to look after pocket money, you have to physically look after it. You have to know where it is. You have to not leave it in your jeans and put it in the wash. You have to get it back if you've lent it to somebody. And it has so much more meaning than if it's digital. And some of the best cases I've seen of young people who can manage money responsibly are the ones who have had to do that.
Physically.
Physically look after money. Even better yet, work on a shop floor and handle cash. But okay, that's not for everybody. But.
And how early can you start that?
Oh, I'd say 6, 7.
I do that with my son. And he's got a little piggy bank, and we every few months we set aside some time to. So he's got three jars. One is a gifting jar, one's a saving jar, and one's a spending jar.
Wonderful, I love that.
And every few months we have an opportunity on a Saturday to go. We haven't done it yet. He keeps telling me, "Daddy, when are we going to do this?" You've said we, but we have an opportunity to decide what we're going to gift the money to and how much, what we're going to do with our savings, and what we're going to spend it on. And it's really fun. I'm really interested in this type of stuff, but it's time consuming, and there's a lot of extra thought and time resource that can go into this.
It is, but it's also, it sounds to me that it's also bonding for you, because you're doing these things together.
Yeah.
And neither of you are going to be on any devices. You're most likely going to be physically holding something, looking at something out in the world. And therefore, I wouldn't look at it that way. I'd look at it as bonding time, with money just being, you know, the vessel. Based on experience and working with over now 150 young people over the last 10 years at Dallington for over a year at a time, so getting really good experience and data from that, really, the young adults that are most well adjusted and can handle with everyday life like anybody else can, are the ones whose childhood better resembled real life. By that I mean they had chores, they had consequences, they learned to deal with conflict, they learned to persevere, they had to be part of a community, they had to work in groups. Those are the ones who are able to get through interviews and
most prepared.
Yeah.
How do you deal with peer pressure in those instances, because from parents and from children? I mean, if you're at a smart boarding school and all your friends are in the same environment and your parents are trying to,
it's huge. You're right. I mean, the peer pressure on the parents,
well, it's parent to parent. So, you know, a lot of the people I'm making friends with are my children's parents.
Yeah.
And we're still early on in that, but I can imagine there'd be pressure between parents. So, I mean, even now we're going to, and my kids aren't at a private school, they're at a state school, but we go to birthday parties every weekend. And my son's birthday was at the end of January, and all he had 15 people over, and he had 15 of the most extraordinary presents I've ever seen. And I'm so grateful that the parents and the children that came were so generous and so caring. But I'm also like, do I want my son to have 15 big boxes? And so there's this peer pressure between parents that there's this expectation that love is shown through giving and sort of wealth, like the commodity that you're giving. So there's a peer pressure between parents and, you know, oh, well, I'm not allowing my kids to watch TV, but when they come over to your house, they watch TV all the time. And can you actually not give us so many presents because it's a bit too overwhelming? And then between kids, if you were, you know, if you were at a smart private school and you're, you know, there's a chauffeur collecting all of your friends and they're going off on private jets to these holidays and those holidays, but you're wanting your kid to go and work on a shop floor for the holiday. How do you manage that?
You've really got to find the balance, and it is difficult. Of course it is. I would always lean into being different is a good thing. And most young people at some point want to, whilst being the same and accepted is very important, standing out and having the confidence to do something different is important and can be modelled by your parents. So again, if you think about your parents, I'm sure they modelled something different to maybe some of their peers, I'm not sure. And to do the same, which is also to talk about it, say, I know that so-and-so gets driven in a chauffeur-driven car. That's not the way that, you know, we do things, because this is where, these are our values or this is our traditions. There's no judgment on that family. They can choose to spend their money however they want. This is how we're doing it, though.
So that open communication is
really, really important. And also,
so not hiding the money.
Not hiding. And that's another topic. So this issue of secrecy around wealth. If parents haven't told their child that they have a significant net worth or they have a company that's publicly listed or known, that's going to be a problem one day, because their child can Google that, or worse, a friend of theirs does and tells them.
I'm sure that's happened.
It does happen. And then you have to think, well, most secrets are negative. You know, not all. There are some very special and exciting secrets that we have from each other. But on the whole, they are negative things. And so I would ask parents, why haven't you told them what's going on for you and your internal dynamics regarding that? But also to decide when you're going to tell them and how, because there is an appropriate age. And if you leave it too late, for example, worst case scenarios are when families tell their children when they're about between 18 and 21 that they have a trust that they can access when they're 30. Do you know what that does? I'm just going to enjoy, you know, the next 10 years and wait for it. Of course, hugely disincentivizes them.
And so how do you best manage that, for example?
Well, I would always argue that that's not the best way to structure trust. So there's that, or you put it into things like property where they can actually live and take care of an asset. And it can also be removed, because it's not, you know, this is a gift and it's not necessarily a right. And it's really important they learn to respect those things. So again, this is about boundaries, it's about consequences, about saying this is, when I say expectations, I'm not talking about expectations of your career and like, I'm just, we're gifting you something, this is how we expect you to take care of it. In the same way, I'm sure with your children, if you give them something and they break it, which they will, as do mine, you say that costs somebody something and that's not acceptable and I'm not happy with you about that. They need to know that.
How do you put that? I mean, I've been trying to figure that out. I'm saving some money to hopefully provide them with some kind of something. Yeah. And I've been very keen on not wanting to... I want them to work hard and to find this resilience on their own. But my way before this conversation, my concept has been that they shouldn't be aware of this potential money, however much it might be, because I don't want it to disincentivize the work and the sort of those values that I think are so important.
Your parents did this well.
Yeah.
What did they do for you? I would say it was modeling.
Yeah. I suppose it's the language and it's how you communicate it.
I think financial education is really important, and let's be frank, it's not taught in schools. really. Wasn't in my day. It's still not today, as I see for my students, mentees who are at school and at university. The average young person is not going to volunteer to do financial education because it sounds boring. It sounds like maths. So unless they're already incentivized in some way, you have to make it just part of your home education. And if you don't feel that's you need to get, I would say, a friend or somebody who is good at that, because it needs to be someone they feel comfortable around, that they're not, you know, in a boardroom style environment to talk about this. Because as I'm sure you know, the people who speak the most fluently and confidently about the economy and money are the ones who are dealing with it every day, and the ones who are just, you know, it's a language. They have a fluency around it. So you just make it really normal to talk about. And you go in and, for example, most people, myself included, have to regularly go, I can't remember what the price of milk is this week. I mean, that used to be something I was brought up with, which you should know. That was how you understood inflation, which was last week it was this, next month it's that, and that's how you see it. Whereas we are so detached from this now. We order things online, we pay with digital cards, we don't check. So I would just, a lot of the principles that we grew up with are actually some of the best ones. Have physical cash. Go and do a supermarket shop. Look at the different prices.
What's the favourite thing about what you do?
Oh, I have so many. I love it so much. Well, because I was a nightmare teenager, what I really love more than anything is when there's that moment when the young person, they've built the trust and they know that I really see them and I'm really just listening to them. I'm not on an agenda. I'm not trying to improve or fix them. I'm just receiving them exactly as they am. And that is the best feeling. And you can do so much good work once you get to that. But you have to get to that.
That must be tough to get there, but then you're a team.
But then you're a team. And then really sky's the limit and you can do so much good work. And it's also really important that they know that work ends. I'm not a big believer. Actually, I'm very against this concept that we should all be in endless therapy, coaching, gurus. No.
You need your detachment, as you said.
You need your detachment. You need to be able to know that you can do this on your own. So I say to a young person, to a mentee, when I start talking about graduation from Dallington and our process, that's a really positive sign because it means that I know you can go this alone. It doesn't mean I don't want to see you. Even yesterday, I went to see a mentee who graduated 18 months ago for a cup of tea, and it was so lovely just to catch up. I will still be there, but they have to do it alone. That's the best bit.
Do you have a set time frame and a curriculum?
Yeah, the average time young person with us is 18 months, and we see them twice a week on average, which sounds like a lot, but actually if you're in sixth form or university, it's totally doable. And most of them really like doing that, and they can either come in or we see them online. But they have one practical, one personal session a week, roughly. A practical session will look like the basic budgeting, filling out forms, UCAS, applying for jobs, applying for driving licenses, things like that. I should add, I'm not doing it for them. They sit next to me. This is very much shoulder to shoulder. You can do this. But like a Ryanair flight, you don't need that. You don't need that. Pass no. Etc. And the personal session is what's going on in their life, but this is also, we have the curriculum, which is very much a personal emotional intelligence curriculum on things like perseverance, conflict, role playing. How do you have a difficult conversation? Look, I'm all for the STEM subjects, but we have to protect the humanities. We really do. It's so important that speech and drama and those sorts of, how to tell stories, how to communicate with people, that's so important. So, and part of that is conflict. It's about sticking in a debate. Yeah. So the average young person I work with, you will have seen it, I'm sure, which is people just ghost. They don't respond to things, or they avoid for days, or they can get into those messages which are back, forth, instead of any thought. If you have to sit across from somebody, and I give you a title that we have to, whether or not you like the motion of this topic, you're going to defend it. And I'm, for it. It teaches you so much.
Well, that's fascinating. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been really enjoyable.
Yeah. I could ask you hundreds and hundreds of parenting questions.
Well, you're very welcome to. And anybody listening to this is also welcome to. If you have there are top tips, absolutely, that every family can do. And like I've said, things around letting our children suffer a little bit more, letting them make mistakes, pausing before we react, handling physical cash, talking about making fluency around those sorts of topics.
Have you ever thought about writing a book?
I actually have, and I've started one. And it's going to be a very straightforward, non-psychological theory, because those are very, very helpful, and there's more and more, which are wonderful. But this is going to be a guide to raising children in the practical context of success, yeah.
Well, I look forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.